Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Cripescast. This is the podcast where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest. I'm your host, Charlie Behrens, and we are brought to you by Jolly Good Soda. Hey, folks. Welcome back to another episode of the Cripescast. This week, my guest is comedian Rory Scovel. He is so funny, so good. He's coming into Milwaukee and a bunch of dates around the Midwest coming into Milwaukee soon. Check it out. Ticket links and all that. Colleen Maraca, what EP of the Cripescast. Colleen, what day is Rory coming to Milwaukee?
Rory's coming to Milwaukee. He's coming to the Turner Hall Ballroom July 21st. Tickets are at roryscovel.com. He's also got some Minneapolis dates around then, Chicago. So, yeah, if you're not specifically in the Milwaukee area, like, it's the perfect time. It's right in the summer. That's when you ought to be in the Midwest. So he's going to be, long story short, he's going to be in the Midwest.
Yeah.
He's coming here the 21st.
He's so funny too. I mean, if any of you are looking, you know, he's actually talking, we talked in this podcast, he's working, he's tightening up his next hour. So it's going to be a real treat to go see him. So, anyway, we'll chit chat with him in a minute.
You guys also went down like a Catholic church rabbit hole of all.
And let me say this off the top, because I grew up Catholic, he grew up Catholic, and there's a lot of great things about, you know, the Catholic faith and all this and that, and, you know, a lot of people get a lot of good out of it, and I think you certainly can, but I think you also have to acknowledge that the Catholic Church has had some problems, historically speaking, you know, Crusades being one of them. Also the whole pedophilia aspect. So, you know, you can't just look at the positive aspects of something. And, you know, that church, like any other church, is inherently flawed because you got people involved and people are inherently flawed. So to not acknowledge that is a little disingenuous, but that was a disclaimer. With all that said, you know, I think we went, it was really cool talking to him, just because he is sort of a comedian's comedian, you know. Conan really, I think, gave him an awesome platform, really sending him on his career. And he does so many creative, cool things, an entire, you know, stand-up special, just crowd work. His crowd work and improv is so good. His, you know, straight stand-up is amazing. So, I really, like talking to him. And also, you know, we have a lot of similarities. You know, we had the news business. We both come from big families, Catholic families. And, it was kind of cool talking about that. What'd you like about it, Colleen? Tell me what you liked about my podcast, Colleen. Not fishing for compliments at all, but
this is the affirmation. This is the affirmation hour. This is the only time I'm nice to Charlie is when we're on air.
You're not even that. You don't even pretend to be that nice to me on air.
I just want to like make a disclaimer that I am normally a nice person, but I think Charlie just brings the worst out of me.
Oh, that's nice of you to say live on air.
I'm kidding.
That's really nice.
No, I thought it's really funny, like, when we were doing research on this, like, the two of you, there was a lot of crossover, which I think is fun, and also just, like, gives that familiarity to it, and then also, too, like, I think Rosebud Baker said this recently, and then another comic also, just talking about, like, crowd work clips in general, it's just funny that, like, it's a kind of unanimous agreement among most comedians that, like, the crowd work clips... I was like, it just was funny that was coming back up again. And I think I accidentally messaged you, but you did like, you were going on your AI rant and I texted you, or I DM'd you on accident when I was DMing Hannah and I go, geez, Louise. Like,
oh, I saw that midway through. So for those of you who don't know, we do a lot of these interviews with comedians who can't make it into the studio via Zoom. And therefore we have a chat. And Colleen sometimes sends chats meant for Hannah to the whole crew. So yeah, I was talking about AI and climate change, you know, and all that.
If you're like a steady listener of the podcast, you know that like we were, you should just start like a second podcast of like your, or a third podcast other than Bellied Up, of your thoughts just about like climate change and like letting your mind actually wander to like the deepest, darkest spots that you tend to go to.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at it from, you know, that's my background is in it. I'm seeing the writing on the wall get written faster than predicted.
Background is in what? Conspiracy theories?
Okay. Oh, wow. Do you, ladies and gentlemen, if you are interested in executive producing a podcast, please email us, cripescast.com. No, Colleen, I don't think that that's a conspiracy theory, although
it's
I am fascinated by conspiracy theories and by the way, you know, brains sort of can create whatever reality you want to create. And I also have to check myself on that, you know, but no, I think from in college, I specialized. You know what? I don't even want to say that because what it was environmental geography. But okay, Charlie, nice scientific background on it. No, but it's kind of one of my things. I love the natural world. I love Wisconsin's environment. Like my main place to go when I'm like trying to reconnect or just sort of recalibrate is, you know, kind of go into go hiking or go biking or something. There's so much calming in that. And it's like the nature's therapist. I just want to protect it. Not just that, water for everybody, you know, keeping it clean, air, all that sort of stuff.
Funny that you bring that up. I have an annual camping trip that we've talked about, but one of the people just sent in our group chat that we plan stuff in. One of my friends sent in like the science behind a 3-day reset of going into the woods or going and being like without phone or connection or being with nature for 3 days. Mm-hmm. Like I'll send you this video. It's from TikTok, but it's a person on a podcast. That's cut for TikTok. So that's why I can like say it's chill. But basically talking about how like on our day-to-day life, we're operating on like beta waves. And then when you go and reset and you're with nature, it's like, it takes you 3 days kind of to like be on alpha waves. I don't know the science behind it fully, but it basically was saying like, it's good to have a regular reset and go be out in nature. And like, it's scientifically proven that or something that it helps you like perform better as yourself.
Oh, well, that's really interesting. So that being said,
I'm going on vacation every month and like really that, like, that's funny that you say like, that's how I go and reconnect. Cause it's true.
Yeah. And I think the more people kind of get out and do it, the more they kind of have an appreciation for it and also see the changes and all that. And, yeah. So anyways, it's just interesting things we were chit-chatting about. But anyways, folks, I do want to let you know, if you're looking for an interesting environmental way to clothe yourself, we've got a bunch of merchandise on mandoaugment.com, made in the USA, which means lower carbon footprint, also supports American workers. You can check it out, cripescast.com, click on the merch section. And you can also find us patreon.com/CharlieBarron. Two great ways to support the pod. And with that, should we get right into it? Go ahead.
Also, one other thing.
Yeah.
You guys were talking about tour. We have more tour dates coming up. So just like when people email in or whatever, or message in being like, when are tour dates coming up? We update the CripesCast website and CharlieBarron.com pretty much instantaneously as we know tour dates. So if you're like, also, send us places that we should send Charlie for tour dates. But be checking our tour pages pretty regularly. That's when we will let folks know that you're going specific places.
Excellent. That's all I wanted to say. And we also do a first look at tour dates, the initial push on the Patreon. So if you want like those initial blip on tickets, check that out too. All right. Well, that's enough promo-y stuff. Should we dive in, Colleen?
Please.
All right. Let's talk to Rory Scovel. So, where are you right now? Where's your home at? A specific address and location?
Yep. And here's my social and credit card. I am in Los Angeles. I've been gone for about 2 months in Atlanta. And before that, I was doing some the tour, and now I'm back in LA before I start the next leg of this tour.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're coming, I see, to the Turner Hall Ballroom in Milwaukee.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Have you played that venue before?
I have not. No, I've only played Milwaukee one other time. It was a comedy club, and I think it was probably, I don't know, 11 plus years ago. So pretty excited to get back.
Was that the club that was below a strip club?
I think so. Yeah. 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 Yeah, yeah. I can't remember what it was called.
Tap and heels. Yeah. 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 Something like that.
It was a long, long time ago. But yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a goofy one. Not a bad initial premise. I mean, I bet you could do a supercut of all the comedians making fun of that aspect of it. You'd probably get right. A nice little video there.
Opening local banter always included the strip club for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough to avoid it on that, you know? Yeah.
Right.
I'll go. Fine. I'll go talk to the guy upstairs or something like that. Gal upstairs. I don't know. There's some jokes there. Are you excited to go back on tour? Are you enjoying not?
Yeah, I am excited. I was getting into a pretty good rhythm, and then I was fortunate enough to get cast in a movie that shot in Atlanta, so that kind of took me away from it. And so I'm excited. You know, once I had my rhythm going, that feels like such a comfortable space to be in for stand-up. So I'm excited to like find it again. But I will say, sometimes when you take time off, it's kind of great, because then when you go back to do the hour again, it's changed a little bit. You're out of the repeated script of what all the jokes, you know, like they change because you forget a little bit, you know.
Yeah, because you haven't memorized to a degree, or at least the beats, and then you can live in it a little more and take the moments.
That's
you
right.
know, like, you ever shoot a special, and then I'm sure you probably have, and then you're still doing maybe some of the material because the special hasn't come out, and you're like, damn, that should have been the special.
Yeah. And then you also like, you think of a tag that you're like, that was there the whole time. Or like, for some, this is what I love and hate about it. It's like, to your example, like then like the light bulb goes off and you realize, actually, this joke should have gone after that joke, and I should have gotten rid of that one sentence that no one ever laughed at, but for some reason I kept doing it. And then it's always after the fact, and as frustrating as that is, there is something I still love about that as well, where it's kind of always changing and growing, even when you have to walk away from it.
Yeah And I think, you know, I think the next time I do a special, I may like tell myself I'm going to do this special, but no, it's not really the special. I don't think it's going to work, though. I think you need that, like, okay, this is it, to like totally screw yourself mentally. But then that release is when you find a lot of beauty.
I think my goal is at the end of this tour in like November or whatever. We kind of keep finding dates here and there to add, but I'm hoping that all of this repetition of doing it over and over again, that either I do find those sweet gems that you're talking about that kind of appear out of nowhere before we record, or I get so tired of doing this hour that I don't even
care.
As soon as we shoot, I don't know that for us comics that there is a perfect special where you go, and that was me peaking, and that was when I loved it. It's like, no, we usually record when we're so tired of it.
I know.
Too early, or we do it too early where it hasn't cooked enough.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then there's always that one show. Like, for me, it was like, I think Minneapolis at the State Theater. I'm like, that I should have recorded.
Yeah.
That was it. And no, I didn't do anything. I don't even think I recorded the audio on it, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe that's just it. It's better in my memory, you know, than it actually was. That could be.
You know what I think? I think it's because I think what we do is so with that, because it's a live experience, it's so with that live crowd.
Yeah.
That us recording albums, which is a kind of a different story, but, you know, recording specials, it's kind of not ever going to accurately grab what it is we do, because as soon as those cameras are on and the stakes are raised, we're no longer up there just kind of noodling around with the guitar, having fun. We're it's got to be perfect and it's got to be concrete, because when I die, this will still,
I know,
this will be my legacy. We think so grandeur of ourselves that we think this matters so much. And on nights where you don't have the camera going, you and an audience walk, so like you're saying at the State Theater, you and an audience walk away going, that was the greatest night, that was the greatest show. But yet it wouldn't have been if you would have put four or five cameras up.
That's really it. So the trick then is, you know, we just have to spend all the money that we would make on these shows filming every show, and then we'll have no money but a great show somewhere in there.
And then and then also chop them all together where our clothes are changing, the backdrop is changing.
Yeah, you know, Adam Sandler did that on, I forget, like 99% Fresh or whatever.
His last one. Yeah.
Have you ever seen any other comedians do it that way, where you take like clips from different places?
You'd have to have a crazy budget. And so,
oh, yeah, because you'd have to film all of
them.
Yeah.
You'd have to be him and beyond, because you need the crew. You've got to have your director. I can't even imagine what sitting down and cutting that thing been like.
I'm
glad I did it. No one else would. You'd have to be his level of fame to get that budget to do it. And if I had that, I don't know that I would want to do that. I think I'd still be like, no, let's not shoot everything.
Because it kind of it can get in the way a little bit. I mean, now guys are bringing camera people out, you know, to every shoot to get those crowd work clips.
Those clips.
Yeah.
And that's really helping our craft. And I've always appreciated that.
I can just feel I'm bathing in the sarcasm right now. How do you truly feel about that? I mean, it's
I don't know. I think all of us as individual artists and employees have to survive. And I think we live in a strange time, and also we work in a strange medium of live entertainment, and we've got to do what we got to do. I think overall, I like posting clips that are jokes that I just don't do anymore, and hopefully that gains me some ticket sales. Hopefully that gets people to come to a
show.
That's
why we're doing
but I don't want people showing up assuming, I love crowd work, I like doing that stuff too, but I don't want anybody showing up assuming that is what I do and that's what I want them to actively participate in and inspire and go after, because I really want to do my act and I want to be in control of the show, and I don't want to have to throw people out. I don't want to remind someone a 10th time to stop talking. But I think there's people that go to shows now actively wanting to be in a clip, wanting to be something. Oh yeah, I saw that on their page. That's my voice. That's me in the crowd.
Yeah, and now there's shooting of the crowd, so now there's that further invitation.
Yeah.
I mean, have you noticed a distinct change in that in your shows with your audience?
I think because this is a tour. I mean, if I was just doing clubs right now, I might notice that. That might be the case. But I think maybe because it's more these theaters and less clubs, you get less of that. You know, you don't see a lot of clips where people are playing a theater and getting crowd work stuff. And again, like I'm not anti crowd work, but if you post a bunch of clips of just doing crowd work, I think I personally, as an audience member, I would wonder what is the product. And I get it, you don't want to burn material, and that's why I sit here saying everyone's got to do their own thing, because I couldn't tell you what the solution is. I don't know how long you've been doing this. I'm on, I think, 18 or 19 years. I liked it back when this was not a part of our craft. You just wrote your thing and you tried to collect email addresses.
Right. Get your list going. Yeah. Give me your email address. I'll give you a free sticker, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Those days are obviously long gone, but I appreciated that when it was like, oh yeah. And then you just get up and you do your thing. You play your show, and you don't have to get involved in this other aspect of our craft. I mean, getting up and doing stand-up alone, you know, the amount of people that say, I don't know how you can do it, even though you know how you can do it. And it's not as crazy as people's interpretation of it is. But still, a lot of people don't want to publicly speak under any circumstances. And yet we are able to get up there and do it. And it is still a hard thing to do, to entertain people. And it'd be captivating and interesting for anywhere from 20 to 60 minutes. That is a tough thing to do, and to craft an act that can accomplish it. Then on top of it, it's like, now also be your own web designer and be your own clip yeah. maker and be your own. And you know, look at us. I mean, I have a podcast. You've got a podcast. We're having to like find these other outlets of promoting ourselves. And
we're doing
these other fields.
Five different jobs, six different jobs. Do you have a team helping you out? Or are you doing all this kind of?
For helping me out with clips, I have a friend, Chad, who was doing stuff for Todd Glass, and now he started doing mining clips for me and posting Instagram and TikTok and YouTube and all the various outlets of trying to get people aware of you. But I'd say it's like basically him doing it. I have a friend, Garrett, who redid my website.
Shout out to Garrett. Shout out
Garrett,
Chad.
Garrett Boatman, Chad Maxwell. But yeah, I don't know. It's all confusing me because I'm pretty lazy in general. I like getting on stage and doing stand up and having that be my job. Let me create the product. And if someone's like, this is what we should do with the product, well, then I'm all ears and I'm open to someone doing it. I just don't want to be the one to do it because I just want to focus on what we do, which... And these are the things I enjoy. I like getting on stage and I like doing my podcast. I love those things.
Yeah. Because the other aspect, the editing, all that puts you in such a different headspace and it burns you out quick, I think.
Yeah. It's like trying to make a movie and deciding you're going to be the head of every department. It's like, right. You can't do wardrobe. You can't do makeup and hair and set design. Yeah. You just do the thing you did, which is write it or direct it or act in it. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It's too much.
Yeah. It is a lot. You have some of the, I mean, craziest crowd work, though. I forget. I didn't see this. I think I heard this a little while ago. So if I get this story wrong, excuse me. But you were doing a show maybe in New York or something, and you're doing crowd work, and you just walked out of the club and brought your mic was still on so they could still hear you, and then you right. talked to like a taxi driver or something and brought him back on stage.
I did that in San Diego.
Okay.
I was down there doing Conan's, you know, he does Conan Con like he does during Comic-Con.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we were down there, and at the time I was doing my fully improvised hour type shows, and they asked if I wanted to do it. So I was in a venue where the door off the stage really went right into the street, and there was a limo driver, but now it's not limos, it's like these nice black SUVs. It was like a driver.
Yeah.
And he was just standing there, and for some reason was willing to come back on stage, and I gave him a microphone and just kind of chatted with him and interviewed him. But it was funny because he was waiting on someone who was at my show without that person to be like leaving. They were leaving early.
That's hilarious.
But, you know, when you're improvising an hour, you're like, oh, I need all the wood possible to keep feeding the fire. So as soon as that was outed, like that gave me a direction to go.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love that. That working was all hinged on that guy being down to play, and obviously like he was super chill too.
So when you take like a risk like that, I mean, that's the high, and you've got to probably, I would imagine, have an equal low. Do you have like something where you tried going big and it just bombed horrendously?
Nothing comes to mind. I mean, and it's probably because our brains protect us. So all those, all those times I've bombed, my brain's like, delete that, delete it. Only remember the good. Yeah. I don't know that there was any time where I tried to go super big with something and it didn't pan out to be anything. Cause I'm always very cautious. Like if that guy would have come on stage and his vibe would have been strange, I probably would have, you know, I waited a second before I gave him a mic to participate. Okay. You know what I mean? You're trying to read you're trying to read the defense a little bit before you throw the ball. So I haven't run into taking big swings and then it not
pan out. I've taken big swings where, actually, no, I have one example that was a kind of a tough recovery. I was performing in Tampa Bay. I think it was the Improv, and someone got up to go to the bathroom. And so I got a second microphone. I put my microphone on the stage, and I've done this before, and I think it's really funny, but I put the microphone on stage, and then I went and hid with another microphone, and I told the audience to pretend like they can still see me on stage. So when that person comes back, they're like, what are we looking at? Maybe it looks weird to them. And that person was leaving. They never came back.
Oh, really?
They weren't going. They were done with the show. All of my stories involve people leaving early. They were leaving the show. And so eventually, after 5 minutes, I just had to get back on stage with an entire audience being like, why did we do what in the fuck was that? And then, you know, going straight to material to be like, all right, let's see if I have any A cards that can try to build some momentum again.
Well, that's
I also
fun.
Stupidly did it towards the end of the show, too. So,
oh, like, yeah. A,
you know what I mean?
That's definitely a middle portion, you know?
Yes.
Where you can, they're either clearly mad and leaving. There's not really mistaking the bathroom for jetting out of there early to beat the rush of traffic. In Tampa, beat those chickens. They got so many wild chickens down there.
Yeah. No, Tampa's a strange, that? Florida's a strange state.
It is general. A strange, strange state. Yeah. It's, it's crazy, man. And also, like, I was talking to some people, it got leveled by the, hurricane and like Fort Myers, I think they're like, yeah, it's all leveled. I'm like, so are people going to rebuild there? They're like, oh yeah, that's a hot real estate market. I'm like, wow, we are just dumb people in general. You know, we are just, you know, like
it's the best place to live for till the next hurricane.
You're right, which will be any day now, you know?
Yeah.
It's nuts. I don't know what that's about. Hottest day of the year ever recorded a couple days ago.
In Florida or what?
Everywhere. Around the planet.
Overall records were broken.
Yeah. 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 That's interesting. Surprising? Yeah. Surprising to you?
Not surprising, eternally terrifying. Mm-hmm. I go down that road of politics and environmental concern and live in that eternal question mark of, well, where outside of myself doing the best I can to not be trying to not endanger the environment.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do? Because I think we're learning more and more. It's becoming more and more difficult to convince anyone of any slight change that might be positively affecting anything. And so you kind of just are like, all right, well, I think about my own health. I just go, all right, you know what? If someone eats meat and they go, it's fine, eat a ton of meat. And then someone says, eat less meat, it's better for your body. And then someone says, don't eat any meat at all. It's really bad for the environment. I live in that space of going, well, I don't need anyone to convince me that eating a lot of meat is unhealthy. That should be a logical thing. Now, the road of no meat or less meat, that's do what you want. I fully believe our agriculture is destroying I think it is the main contributing factor of our climate issues. But for me personally, who was raised on meat, I'm not sitting here 100% not eating meat as someone aware of the problem. So with me being in that mind frame, I don't know how you convince someone who couldn't even fathom these ideas as being, you know, as changing positively towards any kind of change. I don't know. That was a confusing sentence. But I think
no, I get what you're saying. If you yourself knowing everything can't be fully on board with it, how can you expect to convince someone whose entire livelihood depends on that kind of situation?
Yes, exactly.
I'm kind of there with you on that. Yeah. And then the interesting thing is it's possible that all this AI stuff can figure out how to, you know, sequester carbon more efficiently than we can. And then the question is, you know, do we all, you know, is it climate change that takes care of humanity, or is it AI, you know, that takes care of humanity? And by takes care, I mean,
takes kills.
Goner. Yep. Yeah. They're a no go anymore. You know,
they're gone. You know, I, The AI thing is interesting because it there is this element of hope and this element of fear at the same time, because and the fear is justified, but it does also come from a place of fictional storytelling where all we've ever told ourselves is that robots are not our friends and intelligent, non-life forms, non-living entities will want to kill us. We've been told that. And so Terminator. We believe that. And it doesn't mean, exactly. And it doesn't mean we're wrong. And you know, I think it's right to be fearful of anything, like, until you really understand what it is. But we never kind of go down the road of, like, is there any percentage of something positive to gain from this, from something that is going to be smarter than us? Do we have to assume that it will be evil? Do we have to assume that it will learn that we are the problem? Or will it develop and just actually want to help us and be motivated to help us? I know this is a very broad statement because we can't fully identify what all things AI truly is or can be. But I wonder, can we benefit from it ultimately in a coexist kind of way? Can AI be the thing that goes, you know, because humans trying to create peace with humans doesn't work.
Well, I mean, and I always wonder, you know,
if aliens came down from space, would that be the thing that gets everybody on Earth going, you know, oh, we're all on the same team because we actually need another thing.
Right. We need enemy.
Can AI be our moderator that says, hey, you guys need to shut up and listen. You can survive on this planet, but you need to do these things. And then we all just agree that's right or fake news. I read the funniest news thing today is that Republicans are now wanting to block a bill to extinguish disinformation on social media. And they are the political party that hypes how fake the news is. They constantly talk about fake news, and now they don't want to this disinformation. It's
wait. I don't understand this. They this is federal. This is Congress.
Yeah. So I don't know the details of it because I was reading about it. By the way, if anyone listening to this, I get a lot of information from Heather Cox Richardson, which I think is a great outlet for not just current day information, but actual just historical, like, where does, you know, obviously easy one, where does 4th of July come from? But like details of like stories where you go, oh, that's an interesting tidbit from history I didn't know about, you know.
Yeah.
X. But also Judd at Popular Information, and everything should be read with a grain of salt, but I read both of those things. But yesterday, Trump appointed Judge Terry A. Doughty of the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Louisiana issued a preliminary injunction saying the First Amendment prevents the government from trying to stop the spread of disinformation.
Oh, I see. I see. Okay. Well, freedom of speech, I guess, right? So
yes.
And I historically speaking, I suppose yellow journalism, you know, that's kind of what that was. So yeah, I mean, it does. That doesn't mean that's going to make us any better. You know, that's an interesting hill to go up and die on. You know,
I just thought it was funny because it's like, hey, that's it's everyone's First Amendment right to be able to publish fake news is like basically what highlights.
Right. Yeah.
You hate fake news, but now here's the thing going, hey, let's get rid of fake news. You're like, whoa, you can't get rid of fake news. That's not fair.
that is hilarious. Folks, excuse the interruption, but I just want to thank Jolly Good Soda. Jeez Louise, Jolly Good is the best gosh darn soda this side of the Mississippi or that side. You can get it at stores. If it's not in the stores for some reason, just go up to the manager and say, hey, where in the heck is the Jolly Good? And then in the meantime, you can go order it. The best soda in Wisconsin and the universe at jollygoodsoda.com.
Do you think in order to work there, you have to be someone that calls it soda?
Oh, no, no, you can. No, because they'll call it pop. I think they just had to pick one, pop or soda. And, you know, they're random, like Wisconsin. That's kind of soda territory. Fond du Lac, a little bit more pop territory, if I'm going off my Grandpa Bob. But, you know, I think that they would be acceptable of anything unless you call it soda pop. Then you get fired. Just your Coke. Yeah, you can't do that. Ladies and gentlemen, come on. Yeah, that's a very interesting question, Colleen. I don't know the answer, but you can go to jollygoodsoda.com.
Sorry if I got you off track.
No, you were doing great. You were doing great. Okay. And speaking of getting back on track, Fleet Farm has everything you need to get on track to your summer shopping spree. Make your backyard the number one hot spot this summer. Check out the huge selection of patio furniture, fire pits, gazebos, swings, and so much more. And fire up that grill with top brands like Blackstone and Weber with every accessory you could dream of, cooking up those perfect brats and impress everyone. And you're going to find everything to make the best backyard space on the block in one stop. Fleet Farm. We love it. And finally, folks, for all your Midwest merch needs, go to mandwalkmint.com. We're already halfway through summer, folks. I hate to say it. Time flies like a banana, but that means fall's almost here. The football weather, the bonfires, you know, we got them hoodies, ladies and gentlemen. You know what? I'm not even going to say summer's halfway over. Forget that. I hate when people advertise summer halfway over. Forget it. No, summer is here to stay. But just in case it gets a little nippy, check out our sweatshirts, mandwalkminute.com or krebscast.com. Click on the merch section. And, you know, of course, you know, you got to keep cold what keeps your internal sweater consistent. And that's koozies, ladies and gents. We got koozies, all varieties, cribbage boards, cards, whatnot. Check it out, krebscast.com or mandwalkminute.com. Click on the merch section. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to my conversation with Rory Scovel.
Speaking of news, you were a newsman back in the day, weren't you?
Right. Yeah, I worked at a local news station in Spartanburg, South Carolina.
Oh, I was doing Spartanburg camera. Nice.
Yeah, camera. So I had headphones on that were slightly bigger than these, and just framing up shots, getting the anchors.
Oh, you were an in studio guy. Did you ever go out and about, or just in studio?
The only time I went out and about was to try to get footage of as many Friday night high school football games as possible. So you'd go with, there'd be two of you, you'd go as a team. And there in the upstate, there are so many high schools and there's so many games. And I think News Channel 7 prided itself on somehow collecting a significant amount of highlights. Like that was their claim to fame. So we like really hustled. So if you and I were on a team, one of us would drive feverishly to a game. You would jump out and you'd try to get one complete pass, a pan to the scoreboard, you know, cause by the time we report the results of the games are over. Cause it's 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
But the games are always at like 8 PM. So a bunch of different groups of two, sometimes you'd go by yourself, whatever spread people out, and you'd have five high school games you're trying to go get footage of. And you get your standard stuff like there's the cheerleaders, there's the crowd, there's a play, there's the coach mad, there's the scoreboard, and we're off to the next. And then someone would quickly cut all that together, and Pete Yannity would sit there and while all those are playing, the clips are playing, everyone in the studio, we're sitting on the stage. Because you're not getting any footage of the actual anchor. And we're just watching the screen, which keeps showing highlights while we hear him talk about the scores in the game. That was a long story you didn't ask for at all.
No, it's like you're like Nightcrawler for football.
Yes, that is a perfect description. That's exactly right.
I used to do news, too. I did news in Dallas. I was like an anchor kind of. Well, they wanted to do like comedy news. Like it was called Nightcap, a different kind of news. And then after being there for like 3 months, they're like, all right, we tried this. Let's go back to the traditional stuff. And then shortly after that, I lost my job. But it's such a weird thing, local news, and kind of how it's, you know, I think it can be really impactful, but the way they tend to do it, you know, is often not, super, and I don't want to generalize all news stations, but like TV news, such a tough thing to do like actual journalism in. You kind of have a lot of constraints in that.
A lot of constraints. And also, even now, by today's standards of how people, how sensationalized news is, and now news is opinion, talking heads. It's more of a form of entertainment disguised as news.
Yeah,
it has to make it even harder for local news that just wants to tell you that this guy Barry is opening a new milkshake store on Main Street, and here's him.
those are the best ones too. You know those, but yeah, you got like these bigger, like Sinclair or whatever, buying up a bunch of stations, and then you know that's when you get those everyone saying the same script over and over again.
Exactly. Yes. It's
a little disheartening, but speaking of Spartanburg, you're from Greenville. I lived in Greenville for like a year and a half.
When?
I lived there 2011 to like 2013, okay. Somewhere around there.
What took you there?
I'm so glad you asked. It was this thing called 1 Minute News. And okay. There's, do you know Doug Greenlaw at all? Does that name ring a bell? No. Oh, you don't know the Greenlaws down there. Okay. He worked for MTV, and then he started this this like YouTube news channel. So I worked there for like a year and a half. That was my first like on camera position. But yeah, I had a place, I forget, over in one of those old mills that they turned into like condos or whatever.
Off Augusta, off Augusta Road, like Pleasantburg.
Somewhere. I kind of forget the streets, but those sound really familiar. You know?
Yeah, there's I know what you're talking about.
There's a bike path that kind of goes along the river, that sort of thing. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
Greenville's a nice town. Do you like it?
I do like it. It has changed dramatically over the past 20 years since I've been in that area. And it's beautiful. It's a really great city. It has become strangely so many condos that are very expensive, and I've always wondered who lives in these condos that you have to purchase, because the purchase price of those condos is the same as going 5 minutes away and buying actual land and a house.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I don't know the main industry there, but there must be a hospital. That seems like a hospital kind of salary type thing, you know?
It's crazy. Truly it's awesome, but I do think they are going down a road of becoming so many condos. And I don't know anything about the history of cities and their evolution. I mean, maybe that's what all cities are, and it's just not as noticeable. But I do like that it's growing. I think they regret being on every top 10 list for like best mid-sized city in the country to live in. Greenville's always on there, and I think they're regretting that now. I think that before that was a bragging point. Now they're like, shit, everyone is moving here. Like, yeah, everyone looks at that list. They're like, oh, let's move there. That seems like a great place. And they're right. It is. It is a great place.
Did you start doing comedy there? Where did you kind of get your start?
I went up in Spartanburg once before deciding I was going to move to DC, where my sister lived, to sleep on her couch and get a job and start doing open mics.
Okay.
So I didn't really start in Greenville, or really when we talk about like doing it and starting to do it, I didn't really do that till DC.
Well, what was your first? Did they have an open mic in Spartanburg?
So they had an open mic poetry night.
And
So when I graduated, I stuck around. I graduated in 2003, 20 years ago, which seems insane to even say. But I graduated in May of 2003. And that's when I started, you know, I was working at the radio or the news station, news channel. And I just one night was like, you know what, I'm going to go do this open mic poetry night. I'm going to see if I can do stand up. And it was at a place called the Guitar Bar. And I called and they said, we don't run the poetry night. You can do whatever you want. You can tell jokes. For some reason, I thought the rules were so hardened at these things. You know what I mean? Yeah. When you don't know a community. So I was like, well, it's a poetry night. They probably will be angry if I tell jokes. But I got there and the poets, there were four poets, and I brought everybody. I mean, I told so many friends I was going to go on stage. It's December of 2003. The exams have just finished and no one has left for Christmas break yet. So many people showed up. I think it was a Monday night. So many people showed up to watch me do stand up and get drunk because, oh my God, our friend is going to go on stage. This is crazy. There's nothing else to do. Let's go watch this and drink beer. We were going to drink beer anyways. So the guy at the guitar bar said I could do whatever I wanted because I brought the entire audience. The poets, they were like, can you just go last? Because we've never had an audience and we don't want people to leave.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand anything. I mean, I didn't even know what I was going to even be doing up there. So I was like, yeah, whatever. I don't know what this is. But I must have brought like anywhere from 20 to 40 people. I always say that because, you know, our memories decide to exaggerate things. Like there were 100 people there.
Right.
But, you know, it definitely it could have been 40, but it also could have been 20. And anyways, I went on at the end and I talked for like 30 minutes doing crowd work. It was all my friends in the audience. So I did like crowd work. And I also told jokes that I thought were a bit, but I didn't know what I was doing at all.
So, okay. I think this is a very clear indication of what separates you from like most other people. Like most people, their first open mic, they're going to like look it up and not tell a soul and sign up and quietly be terrified, go up there and bomb their face off and not do stand up for another 6 months because they're traumatized. What was it that you had the confidence to bring all these people to your first time on stage and then you do crowd work for most of the time?
Yeah. I mean, not in defense of myself, sort of a devil's mm-hmm. advocate. I think what gave me the confidence to do that was the fact that I invited, you know, the whole audience. So I was literally in front of people that it was easy for me to be in front of.
I see.
But I didn't really invite people thinking, yeah, I didn't mind showing off. I was always funny. I liked getting attention. Even on the soccer team, I would try to like make jokes and I didn't mind doing bits at parties and I didn't mind getting laughed at even if it was negatively. I just didn't mind performing. And so I just told people because I think I kind of thought, hey, they'll enjoy this because maybe I do well and they laugh, but also maybe we have something to laugh about because I am awful at this.
Yeah.
So it's like either way it's entertainment.
Yeah.
To be even crazier, after that night, I was then going to visit my sister in DC on the high of going, oh man, that was fun doing stand up. I get to DC. I look up if there's anywhere for me to go try it up there. We find a place at a Best Western that's doing an open mic night. I show up there. My sister tells all of her friends, my brother's in town and he's going to try stand up. So again, I show up. This time, I think with like 10 of my sister's friends.
Uh-huh.
And again, this place goes, you can't just come here and like get on stage. You have to like sign up. Everyone here was booked to do this show, but there's no one there. And I have 10 audience members. And they know that if I leave, the audience leaves. And I'm not using this as collateral. I don't even know the power I currently have. I don't realize, they need me. I'm not realizing any of that. I'm just like, in my head, I'm like, we'll just watch. We'll just hang out and we'll watch the show then. But they're like, all right, you can get up and do 5 minutes, which, you know, I'm like, cool. Awesome. This will be fun. And so again, I did it. And then I decided after that, hey, I just found in the city paper all of these open mics. Maybe I should move to DC where my sister lives. So it's a comfortable transition. I have a place to stay. She can help me out until I get my feet on the ground. And here's all these open mics I can do. And so the very next thing I do, which is now going to be the third time I've been on stage, I book a farewell show in Spartanburg, South Carolina. And this time I do get about 120 people to show up. I charge $2 and I went on stage for an hour and 20 minutes. And it was miserable. Like I was doing okay in my brain then. Looking back, it was wildly unentertaining and so stupid and so self-serving. But that was my third time on stage. I arrogantly thought, I'll just do like an hour-long show because I'm leaving to go learn to do stand-up. Instead of leaving to go learn to do stand-up, I thought, I already know how to do it.
Did you feel good on stage doing it, like in the moment?
Not Really, because I and this is even more absurd. The night before is when me and my friend Rick sat down to write down some things that I could talk about on stage. And I look back on this and realize that my mentality is still, if you give me the two ingredients, I can figure out what to do with it. Like improv elements, basically.
Yeah,
where it's like,
yeah, yeah.
We sat on the couch and one of the early jokes he and I thought of was, I was always like, why don't homeless people stand outside of churches or banks? Why aren't those the two main places to stand as a homeless person? And there isn't a joke there. There is like an idea of like, hey, maybe that's a good idea. But I just went on stage with that. Like I would write that down and be like, all right, when I go on stage, I'll talk about that.
Yeah.
And this farewell show is when that, hey, I'll just talk about it, because there's now 120 people there. And because I know a lot of them and they are there to see a show, I'm now on stage, not really doing a show, but the crowd work now is not as cute because there's too many people and they don't all know each other. They're different friend groups.
Right. Right.
So now I'm not getting away with, oh, I know the crowd. So there are things where I got laughs, but I think ultimately it was a lot of people sitting there being like, oh, he's leaving town to go do this. Well, I guess we'll see him back here in 4 weeks.
But what I find funny about that is like, you still stayed on stage for an hour, 20 minutes. Most people would have bailed if it wasn't going great after 15, you know? I mean, you had the people, but you gave an hour, you know.
There's an element of I'm willing to commit to things that I'm proud of.
Yeah.
And then there's an element of I am so good and arrogant that I'm not proud of. And those two things converged, and that's what kept me on that stage. I am worth your attention, even though I know I'm not worth your attention.
Right. Right. Well, I think that's what probably makes you great at the whole deal. So when you went to DC, and you like, did you, it seems like you already had your moment where you said, this is what I'm going to do. Did you have doubts that this was going to be your career at that point?
Or at that point, I didn't. I felt weird that I left my college town / kind of hometown, because some people from high school came to the show. I felt weird like I left negatively, like, oh, I had a bad show and now I'm leaving to go do this thing. Like that was my own interpretation of that experience, was, oh, maybe I'm an idiot. But also very excited because I'm about to move to a new city and it's a whole new adventure. And when I got to DC, my sister went out with me, Natalie, and we went to all of the open mics listed, all of the shows that you could go to that were like of a local level, not like the improv or anything, and watched the show, talked to who ran the show, signed up. And it's funny, the wait to get on all of those shows was about a month. So I signed up at all of them and I found the date that I would be coming back to get to perform. And I immediately signed up to start learning improv at Washington Improv Theater, started taking classes, and started going on stage a month later, and was sometimes okay funny, but bombing a lot also. Bombed enough to where I said to my sister, I think I got it wrong. I don't know that, maybe I got lucky. The few times I was good, maybe it just worked. The crowd was good. And I don't know. I don't know why. And my sister gave me the best advice. She said, well, just give it 6 months before you give up. And in 6 months, if it's bad, then it's bad and you can stop doing it. And for whatever reason, that released me from the prison of expectations. All I knew was, hey, in 6 months, I can just not do this anymore if it's shitty, but I'll just do it. And for whatever reason, that pressure of it needing to be good went away instantly. And I started doing a little bit better. I started becoming friends with the other comics. As you know, we do. We feel like we found some underground community that you wouldn't have found in any other context, because the personalities in stand-up are so wildly different but yet we're all crammed together and we realize, oh, we actually are friends, even though this person is wildly into Star Wars and I played college soccer and maybe we don't have anything in common, but we do have a lot in common because we both love stand-up. I started to become friends with a lot of the stand-ups and it just started to get better. I think DC was an incredible place to start stand-up because I think the talent level was really high. A lot of people that were starting were really funny. And so you just fought to keep up and try to be as good as, you know, everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is killer advice from your sister. I remember the first time I went up, it was some coffee shop outdoor. So I really set myself up to fail there. And then I was so horrified by my bomb, I didn't go up on stage for like 6 months after that. So that, you know, whereas you were cranking for 6 months, I was doing nothing. So
yeah.
I love that advice. Speaking of your sister, you have a bunch of siblings, don't you?
I do. Yeah. I'm one of seven kids. We have one full sister and then I have five younger half siblings. We all have a different mother, my older sister and then the five youngest.
Got it. Okay. I'm one of 12. So I found that interesting. Yeah.
Goddamn one of the Duggars over here.
I know. Yep. Yeah. A lot of folks in that family. I'll tell you that much. My parents, you know, they had their hobbies. We'll say it like that. So, did you, were you a Catholic or, something like that?
Catholic.
Grew up Catholic.
Yeah.
Do you,
I feel like it's always Catholic.
It's always Catholic. Catholics with the kids. Did you do Catholic school or anything like that or CCD?
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, did all that. Did Catholic school from kindergarten to eighth grade, then Episcopalian high school. And that's
you
when
switched
I was also
over.
Doing CCD. Yeah, there wasn't at the time they were starting a Catholic high school. But it was so early on. We went to a more established like religious high school. I went there for 3 years. I failed the 10th grade. So I attended 10th grade. So I went 9th, 10th, 10th again. And then I transferred from there to a public school to do 11th and 12th grade.
Okay. So usually if you fail a grade, you go to a different high school. So nobody knows really.
I know.
But you decided to,
and you know, it's
double down on the bomb, huh?
Yeah. So this, I truly think this, also was a massive benefit to my psyche in some way, although I couldn't see it at the time, was that I failed English by 1 point. So all the other classes I passed, and at this particular private school, for me to get credit, I couldn't just go to a summer school or anything and get a better grade and then just move on to the 11th grade. I would have had to have gone to a approved boarding school for the summer that this school said, oh yeah, that they, you know, provide an equivalent education where we will give you the point. And my, you know, that we would have had to pay for that. My dad worked at the post office. He was like, no, you're not, you're just repeating the 10th grade. So I went back to the 10th grade at this school. All my classes, I'm in the 11th grade, but for English, I have to repeat. But overall, my status is that I'm still in the 10th grade. And so the first day of school, all the grades are broken up in a different location in the school to have like assembly.
Yeah.
And I walk in to the 10th grade and everybody goes, oh no, Rory, the juniors are in the theater. And I openly had to be like, no, I have to repeat the 10th grade. And I had to openly state that. I had to swallow it down. I had to deal with it. And also that teacher that failed me by 1 point, she was right. I was a bad student. I was wildly ADHD, undiagnosed at the time. And so I needed like something. I needed to be held back. But it changed me. It made me have to confront this ridicule and sit in it and live with it. And that kind of informed me, created my, you know, core personality, I would say, for the rest of my life. I can now sit in this ridicule of any moment and not really be affected by it. It really started that, you know.
So that's it. That's how you were able to do an hour 20 minutes of which you admit was bombing half the time. Oh my God. that's a lesson to everybody out there who failed the 10th grade, you know. Do stand up. Yeah, do stand up. You're not, accounting is not for you. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay. That's great. Oh, so on the Catholic thing though, do you do like confessions? You do all of that?
Yeah, we did all that. We did confession every Wednesday. We went to mass at school. We did, you did communion in the second grade. You did confirmation, I think, in the seventh grade or something. I don't remember. Somewhere in that middle school region. And yeah, I did all that. And all through high school.
Do you have any confessions that you're particularly proud of?
Oh, so many. So many good ones. You know, I think because of religion and because of my dad, I think I was a pretty well-behaved kid. I was pretty afraid of getting in trouble. So I never was like a troublemaker. I always like thought rules really matter. Like the kids that are always like, who cares about rules? And you get older and you look back and you're like, yeah, I guess they somehow knew. Yeah, some rules are kind of stupid. But as a kid, I thought every single rule really mattered. And like, you had to be a certain way. Because one, I thought you would go to hell. Or two, I just thought I'll get in trouble with my dad.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I still think I might go to hell. Was your dad, is your dad a hard ass?
Not really. I think my dad also like got in trouble and was like a little bit of a troublemaker. And my older sister was kind of like that. But for some reason, my interpretation of like getting in trouble was just like, oh, I'm not going to get to play soccer. You know, when my grades are bad, I didn't get to play soccer. And that really like crushed me. I really loved playing sports. And I would be told like, you're not going to get to go away and play in this tournament, or you're going to get taken off the team. I mean, I was in constant... My grades truly were so bad. I was just in this constant state of having something taken away from me if I can't like get it together or fix it. So I think I behaved because that would have just been one more pile on to a thing that's already, going great, you know?
Got you. Yeah. So with the confession thing, were you someone who like wrote the list out, you know, or did you just kind of say something to get it over with?
I think the irony, I would just say something to get it over with, which, and I say irony because I think that meant I was lying.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. There was one time I told the truth in confession. I confessed to, there was this adoration chapel and there's chain smokers. There would be all these used cigarette butts. So I confessed, me and my buddy, we would go find those used cigarette butts, find some good ones and go smoke them in the woods.
Yeah.
And I confessed to that and the priest like let me have it. And I was like, wow.
Oh.
That's the last time I tell the truth in this place, you know. Forget that. I've learned my lesson.
Yeah.
You know.
Also, at my school / church, because it was all combined, the Monsignor, can't remember what age it was, but the Monsignor was removed because he was accused of molestation
and
pedophilia.
Uh-oh.
And that was such an amazing moment because I watched all of these adults defend him. And looking back, like truly my memories, even if you looked at pictures in our yearbook, like he would walk around at lunch and like be touching our shoulders and like going around to, like, and like adults would watch him do this. And then when he was accused of this, I watched them all like really defend him and saying, you know, oh, these people just want attention. These everyone wants the attention of I was molested. That's such good attention. You get so many endorsements. You get so many endorsements out of that kind of accusation. But he was accused of this. And it wasn't until recently, and by recently, I mean, maybe four or five years ago, I like decided to look up, I Googled him because I was like, what happened with him? He passed away. And right before he died, he confessed that he did molest children. And that solidified something so hardcore in my brain about church and religion and children. Cause I was an altar server.
Yeah.
So I, you know, me and other altar servers, we were around this guy all the time. And it's not like you could prevent that. But I remember after he was accused, what sticks with me the most is the level of defense he received from his congregation. And that informed me of politics, religion, all of this defense of any iconic figure. Just because you've committed something to it, you might end up swallowing your words, kind of thing. So that's been in my brain for so long.
People just few. I think it's the same thing with conspiracy theories, and religion kind of has the same in some cases. You know, I think some people can use religion for good or whatnot, but sometimes sure. You fuse your identity to like the structure of that. So your knee jerk reaction is defend him because he is your protection, you know, against, yes. You know, sort of the ridicule. This is the guy you've been listening to.
Yes. So because otherwise this thing might be wrong. This foundation of this pillar might be wrong, which means you suddenly egotistically feel like you're going to be wrong. And you actually can't see the good in breaking yourself down to the truth.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, so my whole point of bringing all that up is that that is the guy I would have to confess to.
that's such a beautiful irony right there, isn't it? But beautiful, I mean disgusting. As an altar boy, were you like the bell ringer? Were you the guy who brought the book up? What was your favorite altar server job?
When they brought the bells in to be rung at what I think it was like what two or three different moments during like the start of communion, not actual communion, but like the like getting the Eucharist ready and all that.
Yeah.
I remember when that got introduced, that was such a big deal to get to like ring the bells. But also I think it was always a cool thing when you got to lead by carrying the cross.
Yeah.
You got to lead up and put it like in the thing. That felt like very like a big deal.
Yeah. I had some anxiety about doing that because it was like kind of a top heavy cross, you know,
it was tough,
that cross could have easily killed my other altar server buddy. You know, there were a few times that shit almost happened.
Maybe that's universal because I remember that the one we had was also like kind of top heavy and was like a little too heavy for like our age.
Yeah, probably because, you know, they made them out of gold or something. You know, we could give this money to a well-deserving cause or make the thing that was originally wood and make it gold for God knows what reason.
To that point, another moment I remember is that Monsignor at Mass. I think it was like a 6 p.m. Saturday night Mass. I was an altar server. So I'm sitting up there and the Monsignor is, you know, he's in the throne, really, which is what it is. And there's a guy doing the reading, the first reading or something. And this homeless guy who always was around our campus, like off campus, but was always around, hobbles really down the center aisle. And the guy's doing the reading, but like noticing him and then kind of turning to the Monsignor. We all look at the Monsignor like, what is this moment? And the Monsignor is beet red with anger. He's so mad. And the homeless guy hobbles up to the altar and puts $5 on the altar and leaves. And I remember seeing the Monsignor so angry about that. And that has stuck with me as a core memory of what this is. This guy who has nothing gave what he had. And from what you as a structure have taught me, this is the most Christ-like behavior. And yet you who taught me this behavior is mad at this guy because it's interrupting the show.
Right, right. It's interrupting everybody else's checkbook coming
out. Yes, whereas everyone's like, oh, what is he doing at this moment? And you go, I think he's displaying what it means to not have greed or consumerism eat you alive, and he has nothing and he's giving what he has. Like literally this reading is probably about this guy.
If only people were actually listening when it was being read, you know.
Yeah, but I'll never forget that moment because I kind of couldn't believe what I saw because I knew that guy was homeless. I'd seen him at school and around the campus. And yet I looking at Monsignor and how angry he was. And I was like trying to put all this data together. And I was like, wait, and so at a very young age, I was like, what is this really? What are we doing? Because I mean, I still talk about religion heavily in my act because of the upbringing and the constant guilt and the perception of what our life is and what experiences are and what happens when we die. Like all those things, like not plague me, but I have an obsession with them because of the brainwash element of it, if you will, of someone going, no, this is reality. This is what things are. And then to witness a moment like that was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
What is any of this? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I got a lot, you know, anyone who just doesn't like questioning of things or asking why, you know, when they start to like dislike that aspect, that's when, you know, I feel like you're kind of in the wrong place or at least asking the right questions. Yes. You know?
Yes. Yeah.
That's interesting though. And do you still have that? I still got that guilt, you know, for like, it drives, I think, a lot more, maybe more parts of my life than I still want it to. Do you feel like you got that, or have you like kind of released that a little bit?
You know, it's interesting because I keep wondering what the guilt is or what I would feel as someone who hasn't actively participated in any of it. I think I feel more of an anger that it so heavily influences the actions of so many people in a negative way or in a judgmental way. I think I hate what it ultimately is doing to people's perception of each other. But I think I have never been able to release myself of the overlord watching and noticing who's being good or bad in a very Santa Claus kind of fucking
way.
But I think there's also an element of that because my mother passed away on my first birthday. So also my perception of her and any connection that, you know, if someone's like, oh, yeah, and when you die, you'll get to meet your mom, like that kind of like heaven, you'll go to heaven. I think because of that, I also have that overarching, she can see me. She knows what I'm doing. So I think, I don't know if guilt is the right word, but it does kind of mix into that, is that I still have this perception that we are watched and we are tested and all of this exists in this test kind of way. And as much as I don't think I even believe that, I can't seem to cleanse that out of, it's almost like that is so seared into my brain, it can't change, that my perception of our lives is that it is a test of some sort. And I really hate that because it creates guilt for sure, but it also creates a level of unnecessary anxiety and you questioning your thoughts and actions when, you know, some of them you're not even in control of. Like our thoughts, we have no control over our fucking thoughts. Like they're there. Like when, if you're not out hurting people or yourself, then I don't know what better you can be doing outside of someone who's given their life to others in a selfless act of whatever. I don't know what you can do. I feel very neutral as a person. Like, hey, I try to help, but also I don't knowingly hurt anyone.
Right. Do you think, I mean, that's so interesting, that dynamic with your mom too. I mean, do you think, I guess, being raised Catholic with that, I mean, do you think those are foundations for you as a comedian as well? Like having that sort of resentment of kind of like an overlord type thing, or maybe questioning just the systems at play?
I think so in terms of questioning. I think, when people say there's always like events in our lives that maybe influence us to be comedians, I can believe that. I can also believe that that isn't necessarily a necessity.
Because
there's plenty of very funny people who are like, my life was great. And I'm very happy. I just happen to be very funny. I get it. But for me, I would say the tragedy of my mother and religion for sure led to me asking myself a lot of questions that I didn't ask externally, that I just kind of wondered internally, like, well, if God is this, then what is this? And if this is how this got here, then how did that get here? And like, I think it just created in me someone who asks a lot of questions. And that led to me being able to, in my older age, and by older age, I mean around 24, find material because I actively asked questions and I thought about things and I tried to find the other side of things in that sort of and be a little bit of a contrarian to like what people thought. I think because of those two tragedies, I would say the audacity to get on stage and publicly speak, I couldn't really say where that comes from. I think that is an element of something that doesn't exist because there was a tragedy or anything like that. I think we're just wired to be fine with attention and public speaking. And because of our egos, we really like how it feels when people laugh at our ideas.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think there's that, but I would say the other, I don't know. Do you feel like that's true for you? Like 12 being one of 12 kids raised religious, like, oh yeah, that, you know, being one of 12, you're probably trying to stand out, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I think there's something in that. And then also, you know, I think early on I had such like a fear of hell, you know, yes, or whatever that was. It just felt like such a terrible place that, yeah, trying to escape that meant questioning the system that said that that was a real thing that you should fear at all times.
Yeah,
you know, because that doesn't really make sense, you know, at all. If you believe some of the things you said, you know, because the Bible and also what people focused on in the Bible, I think says more about them than it does the Bible, because the Bible says everything, absolutely everything, you know?
Right.
I mean, right. I there's this one bit that I was doing for a minute. I'm not going to repeat the bit, obviously, but it's this passage where this came from Jesus's mouth, where he said, sell your cloak and buy a sword, you know? And it's like, so I don't want to hear anything from anybody about any gay stuff unless you have a sword, at least, you know, because Jesus never said anything about being gay. He didn't, but he was very specific about getting that sword, you know?
At least have a sword.
Yeah. And if you're walking around with a big fat winter coat and no sword, well, that's just a slap in the face to the whole deal right there.
That's right. You know? Yeah. That means you are a devil worshiper. That's when you love the devil.
I mean, that's what I'm thinking, you know? Yeah. But so it's just such a weird thing on what we decide to focus on with the Bible. And it just, I mean, it says more about you than it does that. I think that's my thought, but I think it very much so influenced me, you know?
Yeah.
So anyways, I know we're running out. Oh my gosh, we're overtime. Holy smokes. You know, you talk about religion, it just kind of goes, you know?
once you go down Monsignor's molesting kids, it really extends. It extends.
Anyway, so on this next leg of your tour, I suppose, can people expect, and again, it's at Turner Hall Ballroom in Milwaukee, can people expect sort of the more crowd work side, more of the material side? What do you want to give any insight to what you have in store? Do
no,
you
not it'll like be, doing that? Of the times I've done like the improvised shows, this will not be that. This is a lot of material that was born out of improvised shows in the past, but no, this will be more of a tighter hour that I'm hammering together, and I feel like it's pretty tight, but as we were saying earlier on, it can always be tighter, so I'm in that quest of trying to drop out stuff that gets an okay laugh and things that never get a laugh, and I'm constantly trying to carve it up. But yeah, this will be more of a tight hour that I'd like to try to shoot before the end of the year for a special, and then move on to starting a new act.
Nice.
So yeah.
And for the next special, are you going big room, small room? Do you have any preference on that?
It's such a strange landscape now for specials, shooting them, trying to sell them, trying to get someone to give you money to make them, and also where and when and how. I would love to be, you know, I would say this tour is the biggest venues I've done in my career, and for and so because of that, I'm like, oh yeah, I want to step up and see if I can start doing some of these bigger theaters. But I feel like the reality is, if I'm sitting on my couch to watch a special, I don't really connect that well personally with a special that's shot in this giant venue. And also, I would say right now in my career, I don't know that it I could try to fill a big theater and try to really sell, like, this is where I'm at, even though I'm not really there yet. So I think I'd like a mid-size theater. I think I'm a 500 seater type guy right now. On this tour, we have some that are 1,000 seats. We did the Wilbur in Boston, and that was it wasn't sold out, but that was probably the most people I've been in front of. The 930 Club in DC, that was a big one. But I don't think I can do these giant places and sell two shows worth to shoot a special. And also, I don't think I'd want to. I think I like intimacy. I think what we do is still a jazz club art form, no matter what. I think that's just what it is.
Yeah. And I love that 500. That's such a great sweet spot, because it also avoids people shouting stuff out, thinking of the whole crowd work thing, it's a different vibe, but really, and the laughs are usually good in that, sometimes those bigger theaters, they're meant for music or something. So it dampens the sound. So
I agree. And it kind of travels a little too far. And I agree with that.
That's awesome, man. Well, thank you so much for coming on. If people want to get tickets, where can they go do that?
The best place is RoryScovel.com. Right away, you can scroll and find any of the links to any of the cities that you might be looking for. I think that's the best place to do it. And then, my own podcast, Pen Pals, if anyone is interested in checking that out. That's really my two things are public speaking or pre-recorded co-hosting a show with my friend Daniel.
It's a great podcast too. I definitely recommend people check it out. That's awesome, man. Well, hey, dude, this was such a joy, man. Thank you. I'm a huge fan of you. So thanks for jumping on, and it was awesome to chit chat.
Thank you for the conversation. I appreciate the invite, and I'm glad this worked. This was my therapy. You were my therapist.
Oh, that's good. Thanks. I'm glad that we got, we dove into high school a little bit, early childhood trauma. We got it all. So I love it.
That's right. Awesome. Well, thank you. Man.
Yeah, have a good one. I appreciate you.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye. All right. Huge thanks to Rory for coming on and allowing me to, be his therapist. That's a nice little gig. I feel like we really got somewhere with him, accessing his inner child and whatnot. I feel like I had a little therapy too. It was kind of a mutual go there. So anywho, Colleen, where can you, I know Rory just said it, but do you want to remind folks where they can find all his stuff?
Yeah, find Rory on social media at Rory Scovel, RoryScovel. And then he has his podcast, Pen Pals, wherever you get your podcasts. For tour dates near you, specifically the Turner Hall Ballroom, go to in Milwaukee on July 21st. Go to RoryScovel.com. But he's also in Chicago, Iowa, Indiana, all this fun stuff. So head up there. And then his specials are online on his website. It's linked, and they're pretty funny. So yeah, go check that out at RoryScovel.com. And then find us on all platforms at CrapesCast, at Charlie Barron's, at Manitowoc Minute, across the board. And if you want to see behind the scenes, this week we put out a Q&A with fans, and Charlie answered questions specifically about birding, which was just so riveting.
Love it.
Go to patreon.com/CharlieBarron's and you can see that there. If you're listening to the podcast anywhere, please subscribe and rate and give us any feedback you want, only if it's nice. Specifically, you can see our video on Spotify and YouTube.
Awesome. Colleen Maraca, thank you so much. Shout out to Hannah Milos for editing this sucker, and everybody else, you keep her moving and watch for deer. Bye-bye.
So roll out the barrel and get the band brewing. Life's got you down, just keep her moving. It's on Wisconsin, the Badgers say it's the old Wisconsin Jubilee.
You know, sometimes when you're ice fishing, you put your foot into walleye hole and go ass over tea kettle, and you think you're done. No, you gotta keep her moving.